He wondered what it felt like to wipe away someone's life to make room for your own. He trained himself not to want anything.
Christmas and birthdays were the worst, occasions built around the wanting of things.
When his parents had asked him to write his list for Santa Claus, Gavin had had to consult his classmates. As if he were conducting an anthropological study, he'd survey boys about what would make them happy. Lego sets or Nintendo, whatever got the most votes, that's what he'd pretend to want. Unwrapping it, he'd have to pretend his delight. He couldn't allow himself to consider what he really wanted. The next question asked, "Have you sought professional mental health counseling?" He'd begun his secret life by shoplifting clothes. He'd walk through Sears and try on shirts, walking out wearing a new shirt underneath his old shirt, a coat underneath his coat. After Sears, he'd hit JCPenney or Nordstrom. He could never explain a shopping bag filled with leather jackets to his mother. The solution was to take his loot to the mall office and relinquish it at the lost and found, always filling out a card with his name and contact information. After 3 weeks, when no one appeared to claim these items no one had actually lost, the mall would phone to say they were his. Problem solved. It was the perfect laundering scheme. But it couldn't keep pace with his stealing. The mall staff and his parents would only accept him discovering so many windfall bags of designer shoes and belts. Everything always his exact size. He was immensely proud of his skill at something he could never share with his parents. Besides, owning the clothes wasn't the point. The joy was in finding the item and stalking it, circling it, waiting in a lustful trance, ready to pounce. In the clutches of some impulse he couldn't control, he bided his time. Often the shirt wasn't anything he'd ever wear. He might even hate it. But again, the excitement wasn't about owning it forever. If anything, owning the shirt or the jeans filled him with shame. They served as reminders of his werewolf side and how easily he could throw away his law-abiding life. To that end, Gavin had begun to burn the plunder in the family's basement fireplace. On afternoons when his parents were still at work, he'd hold his shirt at arm's length and play the flame of a match along the lurid paisley cloth. Burning the clothes was almost as enjoyable as stealing them. He'd lay flaming pants across the andirons and keep adding shirts and sweaters until they, all of them, were reduced to powdery gray ash. His downfall had been a leather bomber jacket. Red leather. Oxblood. The satin lining had burned, as had the knitted collar and cuffs. But the leather itself had given off black, stinking smoke, the smell of a strand of hair held in a candle flame. He'd been frantically fanning the smoldering pile when his mother had walked into the basement game room. He told her everything. Okay, half of everything. The half he thought he understood, the shoplifting part, and she asked if he'd agree to see a counselor. Enter Dr. Ashanti. Tuesday afternoons, Gavin took a bus to a basement office downtown, part of the county's mental health services program. Payment was according to a sliding scale, but it still meant his mother had to pick up extra hours at work. He'd sit in the waiting room with other pimply boys his own age. Some accompanied by parents, most not. For 1 hour every Tuesday, Gavin sat listening as Dr. Ashanti explained that shoplifting was a pre-sexual impulse. Textbook words. In stalking clothes, Gavin was practicing the skills of seduction, followed by acquisition, ending in divestiture of the desired object. It made sense. What Gavin should do with his impulse was another matter. There in the basement office, the walls covered in corkboard squares, pushpins holding the corners of posters showing sailboats canted dramatically above captions like, "Find the wind that's going where you want to be," Gavin eventually broke. He was slumped in a beanbag chair. The doctor sat in a swivel chair pulled away from his desk. Gavin was looking at a sand candle on the desk. He couldn't look at anyone's face when he finally said it. "I think I'm gay." In a whisper, in case the waiting room kids could hear. Ashanti's response was instant. "No," he shook his head. "You're not." Stunned, Gavin couldn't think of a rebuttal. The denial didn't resolve anything. Gavin risked a look at him. The doctor had steepled his fingertips together. "After talking to you so regularly, I can safely say this is a phase." He shut his eyes and snorted softly as if amused. At the same time, Gavin felt grateful and enraged. The one fear central to his self-identity, it was being flat-out denied. Ashanti spoke with the certainty of a faith healer. "You're not homosexual." All the extra hours his mother had worked, after all the money she'd paid to help resolve this crisis, the doctor was going to deny any issue existed. The money and time would be wasted, and Gavin would be back at square one. Dr. Ashanti glanced at the clock on his desk. The session still had 20 minutes remaining. "Don't you feel better?" he asked. His smug smirk and arched eyebrows seemed mocking. Gavin did not feel better. What happened next was less sex than it was a political act. Gavin was taking part in a game of chicken. He slowly rolled himself out of the beanbag chair and made his way across the carpet. Ashanti didn't stop him. Not even when Gavin knelt between his legs and found the man already erect. Gavin undid the belt, the top button, and pulled down the zipper carefully, stealthily, as if his plan was simply to steal the man's pants. Gavin smirked. Ashanti's face had gone slack, his breathing shallow. His eyes met Gavin's, even as the high school freshman squeezed a fist around the erection that was like a third person in the room, and slid back the foreskin to reveal its leaky purple mushroom. Gavin closed his mouth around it and didn't flinch when the first jet of raw egg white, that hot syrup of sour cream, salt, and onions, hit the back of his throat. Another surge splashed up into his sinuses and bubbled out his nostril. He was no longer a virgin, at least not his throat. This felt less like a sexual act than like someone with a bad sinus infection had sneezed in his mouth. He'd made the doctor wrong. Gavin had proved he was smarter. At least he knew himself. The clock showed that 11 minutes remained in the session. The doctor panted, boneless in his chair. Brown moles spotted his scrotum in profusion, and wiry gray pubic hair exploded from around the base of his limp penis. His untucked dress shirt stretched to cover his round belly. And from this low angle, the loose skin of his neck was gathered into a single fold that looked like a shaved vagina just above the knot of his tie. As unappealing as the man looked, he was still Gavin's first, and Gavin knew he would always remember this moment. Victory or not, it felt more exciting than shoplifting, but only marginally. In the weeks to come, his mother's extra work and money would be paying for something different. Tuesdays, Dr. Ashanti would vehemently deny Gavin's preference, and Gavin would prove him wrong. Learning to vary the experience, pace it, plot it like a thrilling movie, and finally bring things to a climax within scant seconds of the session's end time. Once more, Gavin grew to be an expert at a skill he could never share with his parents. When he first heard about the list, he'd gone online and posted the name Dr. Anthony Ashanti. It seemed like a safe way to channel his hate. Everyone assumed the list was a joke. When within a few hours, 1,700 people had posted their votes to the name, Gavin's eyes were opened. He began to grasp the man's patient load and the secret history of his long career. The waiting room outside his office, filled with brooding teenagers, suddenly took on a new meaning. A harem. There was no overestimating Ashanti's stamina. Ashanti apparently had put the rapist in therapist. Gavin had long stopped his course of treatment by the time Adjustment Day resolved the doctor's life. Under counseling, he wrote, "None." The alley in the back of First Methodist was crowded with tweakers. Everyone waiting for the doors to unlock and the regular meeting. People amped about getting glassed. Nick scoped out a talky kid and asked if he had any vitamin V to sell. "Shit was for real," marveled the kid, scratching and dancing. Everyone knew someone from recovery who'd been a gunman. "Dude tried to recruit me," another one swore morosely. "Wish I'd listened. I'd be rich." Nick countered, "I just need some vitamin H." The kid countered, "You got the new money?" Nick knew what he meant, but no, he didn't have any. The church doors didn't unlock. People were hungry. Drinking water was getting scarce. The social order was in chaos, with no gasoline and electricity browning out. People robbing people of their food, and whispers of people eating cats and dogs, and even people eating people. But Nick knew the magic bullet to make all this apeshit disaster movie agony instantly A-okay was a fat baggie of hydrocodone. Given a year's supply of Vicodin, he needn't sweat finding food or a place to shit. He could ride out the misery. The talky kid, him and all the tweakers, were dispersing. A few obviously headed for the next meeting, to see if they'd open the doors at Ecumenical Ministries. Walking his way was a guy with a dog, a black guy holding a dog by a leash with one hand and carrying a big blue-black book in his other. White fur covered the dog except a black spot around one eye. Pit Mick sort of dog. From talking distance, the guy said, "Nick." Nick asked, "You holding?" The guy shook his head and smiled. "Forget that shit." His name was Jamal, a regular at this meeting until he dropped out a couple months back. Everyone thought he was dead, but here he was. Jamal reached into one back pocket and brought out a handful of something, like playing cards, like a weirdly colored deck of cards. He offered the stack, saying, "Take these. I got plenty. But you need to spend them within a couple of weeks, okay?" The cards were slippery, thin sheets of stiff plastic. Each showed the face of a man, like somebody's dad on television. A handsome face like an actor would have on a television commercial selling gold coins. Nick accepted the cards and fanned them to count how many. They were the new money he'd heard about. Nobody had any, not unless they worked for one of the vigilantes. Dropping to one knee, he stashed the cards in the top of his sock. Some he stuffed in his pockets. Plenty of hungry people around these days. It didn't pay to take chances. Jamal nodded at the dog. "Bouncer and I are boarding a plane in a few days, headed for a new life." He meant in Blacktopia, the nation partitioned exclusively for anyone with the preponderance of sub-Saharan DNA. He said, "It's been an interesting experiment, but it's over." He was referring to black people and white people living together. The whole United States thing, Nick figured. Jamal asked, "In school, you ever read that Grapes of Wrath book?" He shook his head in disgust. "Those people running all over, saying they need to strike back to fix the system. But they never do anything, just dig ditches for a nickel and give birth to dead babies." He spat on the ground. "That book's bullshit." Nick kept one hand tucked in his pocket, touching his windfall. "Yeah, we read it," Jamal asked. What do you suppose was the sense of reading about those useless people? He turned to address the dog, asking, You ever wonder what that book was really teaching us? To Nick, he offered the blue-black book in his hand. Talbot says it's okay to kill yourself with drugs. But he says there's no greater high to be gotten than killing your oppressors. A big diamond glinted in one of his earlobes. Nick asked, Did you kill Brawley? Jamal asked, You ever hear of the Peabody Plantation? He turned and spoke to the dog. We own it, don't we, Bouncer? One entire valley of forests and farmland, and an impressive Greek Revival mansion set down in the center of it. Nick guessed this was in some former state, what used to be Georgia or North Carolina. You have people used to be slaves there? He didn't mean anything harsh. Such a nowhere house just seemed like an odd choice for a one-time druggie. It was tough to imagine Jamal as a farmer. Jamal dug in his pocket and offered up another handful of money cards. Take it. I can't spend it before it all expires. He offered the book and the new money in the same hand like a package deal. It's the law. You'll get arrested for not carrying this book. Nick took them both. Here was somebody, one among the many he'd never see again. Come on, dog, Jamal said. He tugged the leash and the pit followed. The two walked away. Cash in hand, Nick sprinted in heart-racing, sweaty strides in the opposite direction to score a mountain of oxy or hydro and get so fluffed the state of the world wouldn't matter. To catch the talkie kid before he sold his stash to someone else. To Jamal, Adjustment Day was doing the opposite of the Grapes of Wrath book. The book people had to read for seventh grade English, where white people were bullied off their farm, a tractor runs over their house, and they do nothing. A loan officer or some such comes and tells them to move on, and this family does nothing. Yeah, they talk about getting guns and storming the bank to kill the bankers, but they never do it. Instead, this white family hauls ass to California where they get dumped on by the police and worked to death for small change. But they still do nothing. They keep talking about one day, talking about taking up arms in some revolution against the rich man, and all along they do nothing except let their old folks die and get buried in unmarked graves. They let their kids starve. For hundreds of pages, Jamal kept reading, expecting the revolution. And in the end, it's just a dead baby dumped into a creek and some old dying man getting to suck on some young girl's titty. The author, John Steinbeck, had been a pussy, too afraid to make anything happen. He'd abandoned his characters to suffer. As had God. Only a white man had the inflated self-worth to write that book, and only a white man would have the secret pride to read it. It's only the white man who clings to his guilt. Guilt for Adam's fall, guilt for Christ's sacrifice, and for black African slavery. It was clear to Jamal that for whites, their guilt constituted a uniquely white form of boasting. Their breast beating was a humble brag, always saying, We did this. We thwarted God in the garden. We killed his son. We white people will do with other races and natural resources as we see fit. Showing off disguised as a mea culpa. For the white man, his guilt was his biggest badge of accomplishment. Only whites killed the planet with global warming, so only whites could save it. Their boasting never let up. It was the white racket, creating problems so they could rescue everybody. And while school forced kids to read the Pathetic Grapes book, kids volunteered to read The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand. Kids yearned to be Howard Rourke on the witness stand. Schools despised the fact that genius only touches a few men. Geniuses recognized the school teacher's mediocre campaign to teach mediocrity to the mediocre. And kids reject the idea of lifelong suffering and failure. In The Fountainhead, Somebody does what Steinbeck only talks about. That's why kids love Rand's book. How Jamal saw Adjustment Day. It amounted to the happy ending that Grape's book failed to deliver. And today, Jamal and three of his cohorts returned to the State House, victorious. That's not to say Jamal didn't feel conflicted. People ask what it felt like. Adjustment Day, that is. He told them that what he'd done felt like walking into the world's scuzziest bus station, like walking into a stinking world of vomit-coated concrete floors and face-down winos, like wading through this stink to find the men's room, a shithole of dripping pipes and backed-up drains, sidestepping the puddles to get to a toilet, then sitting bare-assed on the still-warm, gooey toilet seat, breathing air that's nothing but accumulated farts, and then looking down and spotting something on the floor. Like looking over, and there next to the filth-streaked toilet bowl, stuck to the crap-dappled, sperm-sprinkled concrete floor, there's an almost pristine-looking 800-milligram OxyContin. To help you tell yourself it's medicine. And by its very nature, medicine kills germs. Somewhere some doctor had prescribed it. A scientist in a laboratory had made it, even if it's spotted with overspray from a bunch of diseased bus station perverts. All that needs doing is to bend over and pry that pill off the floor. Only that one quick, nasty job. Just pop that pill in your mouth and swallow it and everything will be all right. Better than all right. Everything will be perfect. Like a perfection you can't even imagine. That's how Adjustment Day occurred for Jamal in retrospect. And here he was returning to the scene of his, not crime, but triumph. In the State House, the janitors had scrubbed away the blood because they could imagine no other option. Somewhere the widows wept, but the dead were not Jamal's dead. The widows counted as nothing, not compared to the widows and mothers who'd be wailing if the war had been declared and his entire generation had been shipped to some bureaucrat-organized offshore mass execution. A man representing his lineage stood at the front of the great room. Everyone carried a copy of the blue-black book, and everyone smiled. It wasn't the law, but holding a copy of the book everywhere public all the time was motivated by something more frightening than the law. The bullet holes in the paintings couldn't be helped, nor could the divots where ricochets had bounced off the marble columns and panels, details that future tourists would marvel over and photograph. The few remaining senators scurried around the place, doing everyone's bidding. Those old men looked gaunt, eaten away on a cellular level. One man had a scar notched at the top of his ear. He approached, bowing and scraping, and placed a dossier on Jamal's desk, then backed away, still bowing. The man at the lectern leaned into a microphone and announced, "Our first order of business." The warmth of television cameras bathed them. As directed, Jamal stood and held the Talbot book open in both hands and began to read aloud. Act 1, Article 1 of the Declaration of Interdependence. A hush fell over the room as he continued. Jamal risked a glance upward and searched among the faces in the spectators' balcony. Time stretched into forever. The silence waited. He searched among the faces for a particular woman. The waiting, watching faces. And there, standing where he'd stood on Adjustment Day, there the woman stood so high above him. Only then did Jamal return to the book and resume reading. All persons compelled to surrender real property and to relocate to an appropriate homeland must be compensated with an amount of property equal to or greater than that relinquished. Her smile beamed down upon him, her eyes so proud. There stood his mother. People had seen the new money on television, slightly stiff-feeling slips of plastic, too rigid to fold. The colors, vivid combinations of red and blue or yellow and violet. Officially, the order called them Talbots, but everyone knew them as skins. Rumor was the first batches were refined from, somehow crafted from the stretched and bleached skin taken from targeted persons. People seemed to take a hysterical joy from the idea. Instead of being backed by gold or the full faith of the government, or some such, this money was backed by death. The suggestion was always that failure to accept the new currency and honor its face value might result in the rejector being targeted. Never was this stated, not overtly, but the message was always on television and billboards. Please report anyone failing to honor the Talbot. The bills held their face value for as long as a season, but faded faster in strong light and fastest in sunlight. A faded bill held less value as the markers along the edges became illegible. But even when the skin had faded to a slip of whitish, slightly opaque plastic, not unlike a bleached and dried rectangle of parchment or lambskin, fueling the rumors each was a souvenir scalped from a television newscaster or a college professor, even when the skins were anonymous whitish cards, they still held a slight value. These faded blanks, most referred to them as blanks, could still be returned to the government for a small refund. Children collected them from trash bins, or the homeless gathered them from the gutter like aluminum cans and glass bottles for recycling. 100 blanks were worth a 5 Talbot note. Thus, they were the equivalent of an old order nickel. Incentive sufficient to keep children recovering them. The lineages that for so long had sunk themselves deeper and deeper, man by man, like taproots into society. They'd come to form long chains that permeated across all social groups. Now these channels of men were used to suffuse the new society with its currency. The man above him, Garrett Dawson, gave Charlie a cardboard box containing 100,000 Talbots and told him to spend what he could and pass the balance to the man below him, along with the same orders. Charlie bought a necktie and planned to keep the rest of the money. But the next day, Garrett came to him with another box, and a third on the third day. All along, the Talbots were fading infinitesimally, and Charlie was forced by good sense to begin passing them along to the next man, who spent what he could and passed the balance to the next. In this way, the money flowed down the length of each lineage, making those men wealthy beyond their dreams and making the people who knew them wealthy, and the people who knew those people rich, and those who knew those rich people became well off. And in this way, the new economy began to float and stabilize itself. The new money cascaded down. It bucketed from man to man. Because the money could not be hoarded, many tried to trade it for gold and diamonds, but those who held the gold and diamonds refused to sell. And thus, gold and diamonds fell out of circulation and lost all value. They became like masterpiece paintings, items traded among the rich as signs of status. But they meant nothing to the majority of people, as the largest fortunes of the old times lost their wealth because they could not use money to make money and knew no other way to survive. Their possessions came to the market. Oh, and the women. They left Charlie breathless, the women who migrated to him in droves, young women, older women presenting their daughters, women who understood the value of their beauty and vitality in this market. To them, Charlie, skinny Charlie, ridiculous Charlie who'd hardly finished high school and could only operate a drill press, these women who'd only ever snubbed him, that is, if they'd even realized he was alive, these days they fought among themselves merely to catch his eye. Mondays and Tuesdays, Charlie sat in a chair at the head of a table littered with photographs. The table had belonged to a medieval king, and the chair to a Renaissance count or whatnot, the names of neither Charlie could remember. Not that it mattered. Now the table and chair and the suits of armor clutching lances that lined the hallways and the flags that fluttered atop the turrets, they belonged to Charlie. A fire blazed, continually replenished with logs carried in by men on Charlie's payroll, while other men fanned him with peacock feathers and others presented braised peacock tongues and peeled grapes, neither of which Charlie could bring himself to eat. And even with the expenses involved in the upkeep of such a household, Charlie could not spend the new money as fast as the lineage required. most of it passed on to the next man and the men beyond him. Mondays and Tuesdays, an agent in his employ brought a selection of women who'd been chosen, hand-picked from the throngs who'd submitted detailed applications. Women with movie star faces and porn movie bodies. They sat in the outer rooms and assessed one another, and the agent escorted each, woman by woman, to the receiving hall where Charlie more or less held court. Most, Charlie dismissed with a glance and a polite thank you. Some he'd invite to come closer. Of the women, some brought business propositions. Some wanted to be appointed to a position in the new government. Whatever the case, Charlie considered them all with the same intent. Within a season, the old order subsided. The new lineages became the knights crowned, dukes and lords who held their rewards by a single successful battle. And those who were family to them benefited, and those who learned to be of service to those fresh noble families housed in ancient estates recently acquired, those who served them best with labor, with food, with entertainment. They were the next most prosperous. And lastly, the persons who could offer no skill except their prowess at manipulating the old currency, restricting its flow and doling it out for fees. That class of persons with their outdated field of expertise, they were left to wander in the street, seeking out the blanks that they carried by the dirty paper sackload, like once ears had been carried, to the counting stations. Regardless of how the skins arrive at the counting houses, there they are cleaned, fitted under a stencil, and re-exposed to ultraviolet light. Revitalized for another 3 months, these Talbots re-enter circulation at the top of the lineage chains. People accepted the new currency with all its flaws because there was no other option. As stated in the Blue-Black Book, first make yourself despicable, then indispensable. The replacement economy was like a balloon being filled with water from a spigot. As more money poured into it, the balloon swelled and hung heavier. But until it was filled, no one could say how large it would grow or what shape it would ultimately assume. If anyone asked Miss Josephine Peabody, the lost politicians were show-offs, showboating snake oil fakirs whose summary executions they had coming. Good riddance and God bless. Rest in peace. No, the natural order, if one followed the classic models of beauty and governance, held that property owners alone should determine what was best for people. For only the owners had the proper vested interest. Planters in particular, in the agrarian tradition of Jefferson, without the corrupting influence of the Jew and to a lesser extent, the Catholic interests. If anyone asked, that is. But no one had. No, it took Arabella coming up from the kitchen one morning to suggest Miss Josephine turn on the idiot box on account of the same man appearing on every channel. A loathsome habit, watching television before supper. But Arabella insisted, standing by Miss Josephine's chair while this man announced, "A house is not a homeland. This calls for the partitioning of the formerly United States in order to provide separate, distinct, autonomous nations wherein each people can conduct their lives. It is wrong for one culture to impose itself upon another, either by actions or expectations. Therefore, each must exist free of the demands placed on it by the other." Miss Josephine pointed the remote control like a scepter to banish the man, but his image and pontificating persisted. "Each group must inhabit a homeland where that group constitutes the norm. Otherwise, either self-destroying self-hatred or other attacking self-aggrandizing occurs. Drinking, drugs, and toxic sexual behaviors arise when cultures are compelled to share public space. No culture should be held to the expectations and subjected to the withering gaze of another." Arabella wore her apron and twisted a dish towel between her hands. She asked, "What's that mean?" It didn't signify, Miss Josephine assured her, and sent her back to shelling peas. Arabella didn't appear convinced, and left the room slow as molasses, walking backwards so she could keep her eyes on the screen. There the man was speechifying, "Just as the genders are separated in most athletic competitions, so should the cultures be removed each from the others, so that one culture might not always dominate." The unhappy result of which being that Arabella's man, Lewis, felt it his duty to show himself into her sitting room doorway, where he approached no closer than the threshold, and tried to claim that Georgia was no longer a state of these United States, but had been given over along with Florida, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, to create some sort of Martin Luther kingdom designated to be inhabited by only blacks. And at this, Miss Josephine wheeled herself to the door and shut it in his face. Despite the evidence of her eyes and ears, the Peabody Plantation remained her property and her home. And before her clan owned it, the land had belonged to the Muscogee Creek and Yamacraw tribes. No gerrymandering tomfoolery would change matters. Here she had stature. If she allowed herself to be uprooted and carted northward, or out west, why, she'd be reduced to nothing more than a garden-variety old lady. A spinster in possession of 36 full place settings of Crown Derby. Some trees were too old in particular to tolerate transplanting. Lest Arabella and the others forget, Miss Josephine was the soul of the plantation. No one but her knew the idiosyncrasies of the well pump or how to drain the cistern. Only she knew the rotation of sorghum versus tobacco. Why, without her expertise, the oil burner and the furnace fan would burn down the house within a year's time. Just let them, Arabella and her man Lewis, and their boys Chester and Lewis Jr. and their girl Little Lorraine, let them see. Let them try and run the place without her say-so. Such knowledge was part and parcel, her province and hers alone. To that effect, they agreed it only fitting she take up residence in the attic of the main house, a narrow suite of dusty rooms, hardly space sufficient to contain the family treasures she insisted follow her into hiding. The tureens and swords, the oil paintings of Daddy and his people. But the attic would suffice only until such a time that this moment's political madness should come to a cessation. At that point, she would be reinstated as mistress with full reign. Mornings, when Arabella brought up her tray, Miss Josephine asked, "Did you call around to the Ives and Caldwells like I asked?" Arabella left the tray and went to making the bed. "I called," she said. "But wasn't nobody left. They relocated." If Arabella was to be believed anymore, every family of European descent had decamped Georgia. When it came to stubborn, Miss Josephine could teach a mule a thing or two. She herself would not be so easily dislodged. Lest anyone get other ideas, she crept out nights. Once the household was abed, she tiptoed her way down the attic stairs, tracing the back stairs to the kitchen. Nights, she might make it her foray to loosen the pressure screw on the propane line, a defect only she knew how to repair. Other nights she'd bleed air into the water main until the pump lost its prime. This mischief amounted to not so much sabotage as merely gentle reminders that her mind was the mind of the home place, the anchorite and soul of the house. She alone could perform the secret rituals to restart the reverse osmosis filters, otherwise the house water was undrinkable. Regardless of the Martin Luther kingdom these people wanted to impose on Georgia, the plantation remained a money-making concern, and she was key to keeping it profitable. Always on television and the radio was that man, Talbot, whoever, preaching, "Allow each culture its own courts of law. Allow each to evolve in isolation." For too long, the differing strains of mankind have been blended into an increasingly blander pool, a culture of shared mediocrity that only serves as a broader field of consumers receptive to the same generic advertising and thus steered to desiring large amounts of a narrow spectrum of products. Cultures developed over millennia, in relative isolation, in climates and conditions that prompted each to create its own imagery and rituals. All of these are being displaced by the global standard. To preserve the integrity of each, the cultures must be allotted living space away from the influence of other cultures. Egged on by some misguided effort to be helpful, Arabella's man tromped up the attic stairs one afternoon to fetch her a book. Lewis offered it in both hands, saying, "Here's the way things are." When she wouldn't accept the gift, he placed it on the table beside her chair and took his leave. It amounted to a large blue-black volume, supposedly penned by that man, Talbot, the television man. A hodgepodge of half-baked observations concerning the obvious it was. Page after page of, for example, in-group crimes may only be dealt with within the same group. Gays decimate their own kind in huge numbers with disease. Blacks annihilate blacks in violent crimes. Whites would appear to be less a danger to fellow whites, until we consider World War II, World War I, the American Civil War, the 100 Years' War, etc. Therefore, the crimes of each group must be judged only by members within that group. To a learned personage such as herself, this was clearly the work of the Jew in league with the Papist, both parties attempting to agitate the pre-existing Negro situation and dispossess the region's Scots-Irish of their ancient birthright. The land had been a wilderness until the arrival of her ancestors, and it would revert to the same without them. Let Arabella and her people try and run the place without her. None but she could comprehend why certain sumps and hollows held water whole summers while others went dry. That night she tiptoed down to the cellar and loosened the lid on every other jar of preserves so the contents would spoil. The morning that followed, Arabella brought up the breakfast tray and set it on the drinks table in front of the settee. She shook out the folded napkin and spread it over Miss Josephine's lap, saying, "The new law says you'll be rightly compensated." Arabella poured the coffee and moved it within reach. She added, "It's not healthy, you alone in this attic day and night." Miss Josephine would not budge. It went without saying that should she depart on foot or in a box, the land would wither. "Thank you very much." Arabella surveyed her with soulful eyes. She'd been born and bred on the place. No doubt she looked to take over as the new mistress. Miss Josephine dismissed her with a curt, "Thank you, that will be all." Alone, she couldn't bring herself to eat. A thought haunted her. What if Arabella and her people sought to poison her? Who would know? Not the neighbors. The old families had relocated. To poison her and bury her. Worse, feed her body to the hogs. That would be the perfect demise. But how to defend herself? How could she prove herself so necessary that folks would continue to feed and look after her? The next day, Arabella brought her breakfast tray and took the warming cover off the eggs. Pouring the coffee, she said, "You should be glad it's not the homosexuals getting this place." As Arabella explained it, the state of California had been set aside to create a homeland for male and female sodomites. Arabella sighed and winced at the very idea. The sordid details of this, Miss Josephine had no desire to know. But Arabella persisted, saying, "Folks should reside among their own kind. That's the idea." She watched as if waiting for a reaction. A corner of her mouth twitched. Miss Josephine, you've got to appreciate that and move forward with your life. Hiding her malice, Miss Josephine gave the woman a bright smile. That'll be all, Arabella. Soon as she was alone, just as she had the day prior, she cut the eggs, fried ham steak, and toast into bite-sized pieces. Following that, she carried the plate into the tiny attic bathroom and flushed the meal down the commode. By nightfall, she was ravenous. Her wheelchair had always been more of a convenience than a necessity, and after midnight she crept down to the kitchen and filled a shopping bag with as much canned tuna fish, awful stuff, canned milk, and saltines as she could carry back upstairs. If Arabella ever took note of the missing items, she never mentioned it. Every morning she brought up the tray, and every afternoon she brought up supper, every bite of which Miss Josephine put down the commode. History books were filled with similar stories of the right-minded who went into hiding until the storm of tyranny had passed, those individuals trapped by evil ideologies. Why, the nation of Israel had practically been founded on the diary of one, a sweet persecuted girl who'd sought refuge in just such an attic apartment. Lord, no, Miss Josephine would not be run off. Hers was still the nation of Thomas Jefferson and her daddy, God rest his soul, and theirs were the Christian ideals for her to uphold. Why, if you asked her daddy, it hadn't been until the 1890s and the flood of immigrants from the Baltic region that conditions had destabilized. In 1890, the nation had fewer than 500,000 Jews. By 1920, it had millions. Nights, if it was raining, she'd venture out to spread rock salt in the garden, or she'd sit in the dark and eat her purloined tuna fish, reading the blue-black book. The last book she'd read in its entirety had been To Kill a Mockingbird, and that had been mistake enough for her, thank you. Who was this Mr. Talbot to go against her?
No amount of political voodoo or civil rights mumbo-jumbo would persuade her.
Days, Lewis would tromp up the stairs to complain. He'd fret how the cellar stunk and was full of flies, and the septic pump had quit on him. The garden had wilted and died almost overnight, so now everything needed to be bought at the Piggly Wiggly. He showed her something like playing cards, plastic cards colored red and yellow. It's the new money, he told her, but it don't last. He described how folks had to work all the time because the money couldn't be saved. Any money we earn, we need to spend before it disappears. If the coast was clear, Miss Josephine would accompany him downstairs and out back to the barn. There she'd ask him to fetch this or that tool to be rid of him while she replaced a widget she'd stolen from the thresher or the tractor some nights before. He'd marvel as she brought each piece of machinery back to life. One night she sat reading the Talbot book, having flushed her dinner of pork side meat and wild rice. Eating saltines and drinking tap water, she came across the line, "A bounty should be paid for information regarding any person living outside his appropriate homeland." Not waiting to read another word, she snuck down and disabled the kitchen stove. She jimmied the gate on the henhouse. Morning brought Arabella with the breakfast tray and the news that they had no eggs on account of raccoons having killed every last hen. There was no bacon or oatmeal because the stove had quit on them. What she brought instead was toast with peanut butter. Miss Josephine put this, too, down the commode. The next night, she decommissioned the toaster. She took the sheet metal back off the clothes washer and stole out a gadget. She disabled the television and the kitchen radio, hobbled the dishwasher. Always preying upon her, eating at her, was the fear that Arabella and Lewis might betray her for reward money. She needed to be more valuable to them than any bounty, more valuable alive than poisoned. At Arabella's request, she ventured forth the next day to tinker with the stove. She sent the woman to search for a screwdriver while she reattached the wire she'd loosened in the toaster. "I see you fixed it," Arabella said, not smiling with the usual relief, her arms folded across her chest. With the day's plague of troubles banished, the woman gave Miss Josephine a lengthy half-eyed stare. She set the screwdriver on the kitchen table and said, "Funny, ain't it? How things just bust?" Her stare not letting up, she said, "If I didn't know better, I'd think we had a gremlin." Miss Josephine poo-pooed the idea. She laughed that Arabella and her people blamed everything on Hans. Arabella didn't share the laugh. "You ailing?" she asked, something in her voice not a helpful concern, but a prying. Miss Josephine made as if she hadn't heard. "I only ask," the house servant said, "because the other day I heard your toilet must have flushed 15-20 times in a row." Hearing that, Josephine resolved not to flush in the daytime. She could hold the day's food, set it aside in her sewing basket, and flush it late at night after Arabella and her man Louis had retired to their own little house. She laughed and picked up the screwdriver off the table and began to totter off. Behind her, Arabella asked, "Where you headed?" Not bothering to hide her annoyance, Miss Josephine answered, "To fix the washer." She gasped, as if to suck the words back. Her mouth froze open. At first, Arabella said nothing. Her not talking filled up the kitchen. With elaborate slowness, in low-slung tone, she asked, "The washer's broke?" A big, broad victory hung in her voice. Miss Josephine turned to face her. She laughed to shake off the mood, saying, "Isn't it?" Arabella said, "Search me." She sucked her teeth and cocked her head as if to study the old woman from a fresh angle. Miss Josephine felt her cheeks burn. She let her eyes drift and shook her head as if stymied by the younger woman's forgetfulness. The stolen gadget hung heavy in the pocket of her housecoat. The screwdriver dropped from her hand and clattered on the linoleum floor. Nick was smart. Not book smart, per se. But his parents' house used to get tagged by graffiti punks. No sooner than Nick's dad had the latest tag painted over or scrubbed away, but another late-night vandal would throw up some new masterpiece. Instead of installing a camera and trying to get the city to pay attention to the problem, Nick actually solved it. One night between taggers, he went out with his own can of spray paint. All down two sides of the house, he wrote swastikas as tall as he could reach. He sprayed the words, "Kill queers" and "Niggers suck." The whole job took less than a can of paint. Not that Nick was a Nazi. He just had a plan. He went to bed. He didn't tell his father or mother. The next morning, their doorbell rang. A television crew was outside. The street was crowded with people taking pictures. His parents were confused and angry, but he could tell they didn't mind the sympathy. After being ignored for so long, dealing with the graffiti alone, they were glad that the problem now belonged to the entire city. The mayor of Portland called a press conference to condemn hate speech, and extra police patrols were added. No tagger punks would dare touch their house in the future and risk being accused of this hate mess. The media lauded his parents as brave, long-suffering heroes, and Nick never told them. That's the kind of smart Nick was. After the household was abed, Miss Josephine soundlessly descended the attic stairs. She needed no light. Every squeaky floorboard was an old friend. No shadow held any surprise for her to stumble over. 57 steps led down to the narrow kitchen door. She held one palm flat against it, pushing softly so the latch would not clack as the other hand turned the knob. The door wouldn't budge. The knob turned, but something kept her from pushing it open. She braced the satin shoulder of her dressing gown against the wood and planted her bare feet a mite wider. Miss Josephine bore into the door with all of her weight, until the old wood barked out a cracking sound. It was locked. The hinge pins located on the outside. Voices whispered and the breathing of the kitchen air conditioner. She fancied she could hear the measured heartbeat of the clock in the front hallway, but she wouldn't swear that what she actually heard wasn't her lifelong memory of hearing that clock. In the dark, she heard people talking who'd been dead since she was a girl. She lowered herself carefully until she sat on the lowest step, hugged her knees to her chest, and listened for anything. And when the first bird signaled the sunrise, she retraced her footsteps back to bed. Back in before times, Walter had closed his eyes to see better with his fingertips. His fingers had tapped and stabbed at the keys of his laptop. His fingers had danced out the words as Talbot spoke them. A bounty would be paid for photographic evidence of anyone in public not carrying a copy of the Talbot book. Talbot had dictated, and Walter had written, "A bounty would be paid for proof of any individual faking a disability." The old man had decreed, "A bounty would be paid for information regarding any person living outside his appropriate homeland." The website Walter had launched at Talbot's instruction was already proving to be a success. America's Least Wanted. People were logging on and registering the names of politicians, academics, and journalists. Hundreds of names. The registered names were racking up votes. Millions of votes. How this would make him rich, Walter couldn't begin to guess. He was an apprentice who couldn't yet see the big picture. He simply took notes as his new old man rambled on. According to Talbot Reynolds, the nation needed an aristocracy. The kings of Europe and Asia hadn't been voted into power. They'd spilled blood, and whoever spilled the most blood gained the most power. The Queen of England and the kings of Sweden and Spain stood atop a mountain of butchered men. Strapped to his chair, shellacked in a few drops of blood leaked from each of a 200 small incisions, he ranted. "Why wait tables when a hail of bullets will be your coronation?" Democracy was a short-lived aberration. He'd insisted that America needed a ruling class of men who'd seize power the way men had always seized power. Men who take action will become this new royalty. Learning a trade was fine. College wasn't for every man. But 30 years into framing houses or wiring buildings, and what will become of your body? Once a man's knees or his back age, how will he earn his livelihood? Adjustment Day was about men joining forces. Walter had looked up from his typing. "So, this is like Fight Club?" His new old man had shaken his head. He'd asked, "Are you referring to the novel?" "What novel?" had asked Walter, his fingers poised above the keyboard. Talbot had smirked. "Hardly," he'd said. "Fight Club was about empowering each man through a series of exercises." His ghastly face shined with its coating of blood. "Fight Club taught each man that he had capacity beyond his greatest concept of himself. Then it set each man free to fulfill his destiny, to build a house, to write a book, to paint a self-portrait." Walter could recall that much from the film. Shaking his head dismissively, Talbot muttered, "Palahniuk. All of his work is about castration. Castration or abortion?" Adjustment Day, Talbot had explained, was to be a model for how men could form an army in order to attain permanent high status. It would draft them to take action before society drafted them. These men would kill on their own behalf, for their own benefit, rather than for the benefit of those who already held power and assets. "What men want," he'd said, "is a structure for communion." As Talbot had seen it, a demographic explosion of young men were becoming men. Men with good educations, healthy and well-fed, who'd been raised to expect a glorious future for themselves. No such future awaited them. The democracy of capitalism guaranteed that only the most banal men, the men with the most moderate intellect and most readily appealing looks and talents, would rise to notoriety. And these would only be a handful from among the millions. Walter had waited, uncertain if this merited writing down. "What happens to the rest of us?" Talbot had smiled and sighed. His eyes blinked and drifted to consider the blood-flecked cement floor. "What happens is what always happens." Going on, he'd claimed that the government had always known Pearl Harbor would be attacked by the Japanese. He'd insisted the government had known all along about the impending destruction of the World Trade Center. The battleship sunk had been practically obsolete. The Twin Towers were a necessary expenditure. In both cases, what the nation had really needed was a war to cull the impending generation of young men reaching adulthood. Such a war would cut down the labor pool and ensure a sizable wage to the survivors. It would throw the surplus men of many countries into combat and stimulate economies the world over. "Most importantly," Talbot had said, "the conflict would create a shortage of men and preserve the patriarchy." Walter hadn't wanted to buy that theory. He'd hesitated to contradict his mentor, but the police and military would stomp out the sort of grassroots insurrection Talbot had described. "Once the police had been sufficiently humiliated and blamed for crime," Talbot had replied, "once the military realizes it's being led to slaughter." Both would look the other way when Adjustment Day came to pass. Members of both might even join the attack, especially if it guaranteed that their descendants would hold power for generations to come. A man might hesitate to kill if it meant only his own benefit. But if his action would crown his sons, and in turn their sons and their sons as royalty in a new society, that man who had no option but to commit murder in someone else's war, that man would gladly create a meritocracy based on murder. At this, Talbot had fallen silent. His gaze had come to rest on the computer in Walter's lap. It was clear the discussion had been over for the time being, when he'd pronounced, "With the exception of members of the police and military, all retirement from public service is suspended until further notice." And in full faith, still not comprehending where any of this was headed, Walter had dutifully typed out the words. As Talbot saw the situation, the clerks and bureaucrats of the world had traded their unstable youth for security and routine, and now that would be all they'd ever have. It was too late for them to kite off to Tuscany and dabble at being painters. It was too late for them to be anyone but themselves. Mid-lecture, Talbot asked, "Have you ever read Flaubert's Bouvard and Pécuchet?"